Hello, it's the Ghost. Welcome to your weekly dose of the real world, where truth is stranger than fiction and things are not always as they seem. Welcome to part two of the Sun God's quest to reunite with his chariot. If you had to give up your most precious item just so you could make it, what would you do with that one chance to get it back? If you knew your precious item had been abandoned, would you go in and get it? Desperate times can lead to drastic measures, but that doesn't always mean that those choices and actions are ones we want to or can live with long term. And at some point, it can become crucial to make things right again. They call me the Ghost. I was an agent for the CIA, but today I'm an independent operative, working on the side of the mysterious and unbelievable. In this story, reality bumps up to the world of legends. Different beings from different sides of life and with completely different understandings of it. And one, desperate enough to find their peace, they ask the other for assistance. Take a listen and enjoy. As always, I've changed the names of all involved and changed other exact details, keeping the feel and the mood of what went on while protecting the privacy where need be. Okay, welcome back to the story of Helios, as it was with Leo and Niles. If you have not listened to part one of this job, I would stop right here and give that a lesson first. The link is in the description. Listen to that to get the full background of what's all going on. The story in full tells of the job and mission to put things back in their right place. During the hard times of losing his son, Helios gave up his one prized possession, the chariot that defined him. And we have agreed to take on the task of returning it to its rightful owner. This story today takes you on the rest of that journey. After agreeing to take this job, a decision I felt I could not avoid after learning all that we did, even on that first visit with Leo and Niles in Palermo, Helios, in all that he was, technically in all that the people made him to be, was here, in our world, looking for the human hands to carry out the task of bringing his chariot out from the depths of the sea and back to him. From what we've learned so far, we know that it was given away in a fair exchange, but since that time has been abandoned and is now out there for the taking. Helios, after ducking into a world of seclusion, is now back and ready to get it back. Unfortunate for Helios, or is it? Let's talk Helios for just a minute. Just because one might be of somewhere else, does it mean that there can be no similarities to us? Does heartbreak and despair exist across the many planes and dimensions out there? Would it not be fair to say that it can exist for everyone? We, as lovely and human as we are, have that small flaw of thinking we are the only ones out there, whether it be our neighbor or someone or something from afar. With this job and the latest occurrences before us, it would seem that the Greek gods, however or whatever that means to you, do. Helios, the great Greek god of the sun, needs something. In a situation not much different from those we find ourselves in at times, say if we feel guilty about something and it's eating away at us, or we have unfinished business that nags at us to be completed. They're not all-powerful over man, at least not now. Back when this was all that existed for many, it was the people's belief in them that gave them their power. Now that those beliefs have faded, the worlds have separated, and any intimidation over us has also faded, if not fizzled. We have come to realize new things since that time, and for the most part no longer believe in what are referred to as Greek gods, who are not really gods at all, they are beings. However you think of them or whatever you think of them, they are there. They're out there. And like us, they need balance. And as for Helios, the chariot is out of place, and therefore his entire existence is off. Now, why does this matter to us? Because like it or not, it could affect us all very badly if he does not get what he's asking for. He's another being asking for help, and the repercussions of refusal could be disastrous. You may or may not believe in aliens, but we all could agree it could be a real bad day for Earth if they were unhappy and wanted to do something about it. It's just a fact. We're not alone, people, and we need to live with that. And whether you know it or not, or choose to believe this either, there are a lot of people out there trying to help defend the great that we have. They're fighting for believers and non-believers alike. You've heard of my jobs before, and if you haven't, you will. And for the most part, they have to do with those living alongside us. But we have dipped into other dimensions in time, and this is no different. You're dipping into a place that exists with us, although not with us at all. It's confusing, but it is there. And by the way, one doesn't even need to really look at this or see this as a job on behalf of Helios or anyone. In all reality, this is for us. What he lost was technically left with us, so that we might not be menaced by those looking for something left behind with us, even though it doesn't belong to us. Technically, it doesn't even exist for us, but again, it's there, and it's something that needs to be dealt with. So let's get into it, because this job was a big deal. After our initial meetings with Niles and Leo, and after this job is officially a go, we had real work to do. Even going to another dimension, like we did with CERN, I mean, that was a little bit easier to get your head around, because you were actually going to a different place, but a real place. This was not the case. This was something in our world, so we had first a couple of things that we needed to really understand. Harley and I ended up moving our entire setup to Leo's, and while getting settled, I called on Frankie and Jagger to join us. If you remember in part one, when we left, those guys were in Philadelphia. And that's how busy we've been. We weren't even all together, but we were all working. Anyway, I get a hold of these guys, and after a quick stop home and a debrief with all of the team, they head to Italy to meet us. Ryder gets to work from the warehouse, organizing some of the things that we know that we'll need, like our boat and our crew that we'll need to use to get where we need to go. We are getting things. Niles is getting organized with regards to navigation, and then Leo, being the cognitive scientist, takes it all on from a mental standpoint. Being in our world while in another, that for us, in the reality we know doesn't even exist, puts us at risk for losing our way. Again, like with CERN, I'll use that again. When I went in to find Chloe, Luke's wife, Chloe had left this side, our dimension, and went to live on the other side. Two separate worlds, separate in all ways, but both were very real. They are very real. She could exist there. Work was there, people were there, her house was there, even her daughter was there. She can live a whole life there, and it's very real. Hard to believe, but easy enough to understand. We know what we're thinking of when we think of another dimension. But with this, it could potentially put someone in a state of shock, trying to understand where you are, and then wondering what was real at all. It's not like we're going in for a quick look around either. We're going in to take something, and we need to stay alert and focused so that we can remove that something. And that's the thing here too, guys. People might think our jobs are all about action, the good and bad guys running around and weapons. Most of the time, forgetting about any of that, it's a mental game. My advice to anyone, keep your mind about you, because in the end, it can and will always save you. That's what I say. So how do we just go underwater, try to find a non-real place, and find this chariot? Because that's what it sounds like we're doing. Well, we found that we would have some help. First off, remember that Niles and his team had worked for years trying to find the Poseidon Palace where the chariot was supposedly abandoned. And they have been there. As I mentioned in part one, too many people came, and Poseidon had to move from the Aegean Sea to the Ionian Sea. And then even more people came, on top of the fact that the people were coming out of their Greek god fog and didn't care about things like Poseidon, Helios, or anything else like that. So Poseidon moved again, to where we're not sure. But Niles is certain that it is in the Ionian Sea, at that palace, that the abandoned chariot lies today. Poseidon left it there, according to all he's read and knows, and so that is where we must go to retrieve it. Secondly, and I also told you in part one, the Book of Truths, Book of Truths around Greek gods, told us to listen to the mother, that it would be the talisman that would provide us the foresight and vision, and that she would show us the way. And that brought us to the box, the one that Leo dug out after getting the hint. And there he found the Mother of Pearl. So that's all that, and that's going to help us. Now, when Niles and his team went down to the site we're going to go to, they did not find what they expected. But what they did find would still help guide us. According to Niles, this location was full at one time, full of all of Poseidon's collected and cherished items. But when he left things there. Why the chariot? Well, no one knows, but he's convinced that it is there. So this is all good to know. Although Poseidon can, and I suppose he has the right to be angry for anyone coming after anything he had there, it doesn't seem to be his new mission in life. And if no one can see it, I suppose he wouldn't see us as a big threat either, right? His things are in our world, but abandoned. Leo explains to us how gods can't just pass through us and into our space in this world like they used to. Our belief in them is just not strong enough, and it's not safe for them. But Helios has made contact. Was that safe for him? How does all of that work? I mean, we can't just call him up and ask, so we need to do our best to try to figure out what we can so that we are best prepared. Prepared for the unknown. Hopefully not Poseidon. And then the challenge of finding and removing the chariot. In the meeting now, that's when Niles breaks out some of the video that he took on his dive down. And this was really cool because it gave us a small view into what we would be doing and where we'd be going. And in the videos, the camera's just following Niles and his travels. We watched as they moved over the outline to where this grand palace would have been. Who knows what it would have looked like or what would have made up the whole place. But you could definitely see that something had been there at one time. His dive did not yield much, but his hope was that the next dive, our dive, could help prove or disprove what he thought he knew. That would be an incredible opportunity, possibly one and maybe the only one in at least our lifetime. When Frankie and Jagger arrive, they bring a bunch of stuff for us from the warehouse. That combined with things we could get through contacts, Leo and Niles, we started to get ourselves set up. One thing was lights, and we wanted a lot of them. Frankie and Jagger also brought our deep sea monitors. You know, divers use monitors for all types of reasons. They're used a lot when filming. And for us, we're going to use them for backup navigation if we need it. It's very easy to get lost and lose direction when you're that deep down. And to get that deep down, we also would need a way to get there. The plan here was that we would be lowered down in a subterranean rig, where we will then be let loose in our atmospheric diving suits. And lastly, and I'm telling you about just the bigger stuff here, we needed that Mother of Pearl. And Leo took care of all of that for us. He had 4 pieces of Mother of Pearl brought in. They were custom cut and polished just for us. Each piece was the same, about 5 inches by 4 in size. They would be attached to us with fiber optic tethers, and then we would also have the ability to attach them to our chests. And I can't help but mention here that while we're working at Leo's, we kept as much of it as we could in his study, where all the action had taken place. You know, this is where any and all Helios activity had already happened, and we don't want to miss anything should anything happen again. I mean, the guy has a great working space in his basement, set up almost like a lab. But no, we bring anything up that we need, and we set up everything right there in his study. And it actually helped. When Frankie and Jagger arrived with all of our things, that glass bottle lit up and glowed, the one with the gold and water in it. Same with when we finally thought we had the monitors all programmed correctly. We'd look over at the painting and the bottle throughout our work, and nothing happened next until we got those things figured out. It gave us a bit of confidence that we were on the right track, and it was almost like a reassurance when we felt we had one area or thing ready. Mentally, as Leo pointed out, it got us also more used to the idea that Helios was there in the first place. But anyway, that kind of gives you an idea, at least, of the things that we were working on in preparation. So when ready, we move from Palermo and out of Leo's to Catania. And Catania is, I'd say, opposite of Palermo in Sicily, but not quite. And it's at that port where we get our boat. The crew I prefer to use on all ocean voyages is there, also waiting for us. Both Niles and Leo will come with us on the sailboat, and Niles would love to dive with us. But because of some health conditions that he's had recently at that time, he can't go, which is really unfortunate. But it's good in one way because it means that I can take my entire team that's there with me out on the exploratory dive. Otherwise, one of us would need to stay back as a point of contact and for safety, which is how I usually do things. But Niles will be back there. We've got about 200 miles to travel. It's about 179 nautical miles. And we're giving ourselves about 2 days to get to our target zone, give or take. We're not going to rush or risk anything. We're not going to veer from our path. And we're just going to get there in one piece. We're stocked for about 10 days for us and the crew. So we're good. I mean, we're overstocked because, well, to me anyway, anytime you go out to sea, you can never be prepared enough. Our journey will begin the minute we descend. In order to get down to wherever we need to go, we meet another crew. There's a boat waiting for us and this giant underwater rig that will serve as our subterranean home while on this job for the most part. This underwater live-in mini lab of sorts that we're going to be going down in is the same one that Niles used when he went down, as is the crew that operates it. My crew on our ship will stay put and wait for us on the surface. And so overall, Leo will stay on the ship with my crew. He'll be the go-between between us and the team back home at the warehouse, if need be. I'm going down. Frankie, Harley, Jagger, and Niles will be going down. And then once down, Harley, Jagger, Frankie, and I will head out for the find. And Niles will stay back on the rig, which is another great level of a go-between to communicate if we need it. Now, on the rig, something very cool, and something that Niles told us about that we hadn't seen in any pictures or anything yet, was this giant spool of light that was hooked up to the rig itself. So you know how in movies when guys go down to the ocean floor and on their rig, and there's just a ton of lights shining down perfectly on everything that they want to show you? Well, we don't have that luxury. Plus, we're not going to be hanging around the rig anyway. That was just to get us down there. And for safety, we're going to have to venture out from that. And it was a lesson learned when Niles took his trip. There was not enough lighting, so he and some engineers designed and put together this thing. On this giant spool was a string of lights that was in protective tubing. Kind of sounds like Christmas lights, but no, these lights were very bright and were inside this tubing for protection. And the idea was, since we couldn't just pull up to where we needed to be, that we could pull the string of lights, actually unroll it off of the spool, and take it with us to use where we needed to really be set up. It would light up large areas at a time, and then we could drag it back, hook it back onto the spool, it would wind itself up, and we could take it back with us. It was pretty slick. Just, you know, when we thought we had learned a ton, there was more to know. Anyway, we get loaded up, and after a small trip down to where we needed to be, took us a little while, and remember, Niles had this part already figured out. We hit bottom, and we were there. And something happens to you when you get down under the surface like that. You know, there's no time. You feel different. It just can't be helped. After the long day we'd felt like we already had, we took a few just to sort of refuel and to get ready for what we had to do. And our first outing was a scoping trip. We wanted to scope out the path that Niles laid out for us to make sure that things were as they were when he was there last. It was also a great way to test out our gear in the environment we'd be in. And it would just give us a chance to come back and ask any questions of Niles, you know, if we needed to, things like that. And thankfully, though, everything went smooth. All things are different underwater, and it always sounds easier than it actually is. But we get used to our suits, and you know, a lot of times when you think of an atmospheric underwater suit, you might be thinking of something close to a space suit, you know, only you'd be underwater. But for us, and like all things as usual, ours were a little bit different than that. We needed our suits for a combination of things. We not only needed to be able to walk around where we were going, we're going to have to get to where we're going. And it's not like we could be there and change out of scuba gear or something. So we had to have something special made. Our suits were originally designed for Niles and his crew, and the overall design, you know, it wasn't approved that way so it could be let loose to the world, but it worked great for him, and it's what we were going to use. They were more sleek than a spacesuit. They were equipped with boots. That's what would help keep us on the ground. However, on our calves were also these little, I guess you'd call them jet packs. It's the best way for me to describe them. We would have no fins and we wouldn't be able to be kicking our way around underwater. So we had to rely on these little motors and propellers to get us through tight spaces and to get us across terrain more quickly. We had our gloves and of course our headgear and our viewports, which were rounded glass. Because we didn't have the luxury of time, you know, to test this all underwater in a pool or something before we left, we really did need this time to get acclimated to the equipment that we were using. We also did a couple of runs getting the rope of lights and getting used to handling that along with the other items that we'd be bringing. Overall, it went pretty good. We did take some time to rest up before we decided to go out for the big trip. And then when the clock said it was the next day, we kept a routine even though we wouldn't even know down there if it was the next day or not. We did our thing, started to get ready like we would on any given morning, and then we suited up and we were ready to head out. We have everything set. We do a check of ourselves right outside of the rig when we get there. Our lights are on for travel. We also grab the rope of lights and take that with us, minding our compasses and follow the directions that Niles provided us. We got in as close as we could when we went down, so we're not all that far away from where we need to be. Not really. The real trick here would be to see if we could actually make our way through the entrance. Because just like Niles said, it was an illusion. If you were to say scuba dive by it, it looked just like a bunch of boulder-like structures packed together. But if you catch it just right, which you'd have to be looking for it, like he said, the view changed. Not instantly, like, oh, there's a rock there, and then, oh, there isn't one. It was almost confusing. What you thought you saw changed. And you were confused because now you thought you were seeing something else. It was a process. Instead of all boulders, now there was an opening. Niles called it magic. We appreciate the moment, but then we move on through that opening. And it wasn't what we expected at all. You might expect to find a small hidden area or a little cavern type thing. But no. Instead, we find ourselves going through this huge mouth of what looks like a giant cave entrance. But we don't find a cave either. Well, I suppose you could think of it as one, but it would be enormous. It was really an entrance to a whole other area, an area within this giant sea, a separate place. It even felt different. You know that feeling when you take a dive or dip on a big roller coaster? You feel kind of pulled down and like a weight passed over you. It was kind of like that, and it only lasted a few seconds. Then it was gone. But when it passed, you knew something shifted. After getting further in, we paused, and I took my mother of pearl out, and I held it in my hand, and I started to reflect it off our rope of lights that was lit up. The gray stone walls that were there on either side of us changed. In the light, the stone took on a tone of blue. I'd never seen anything like it before. This mix of turquoise and royals with white mixed in. It was beautiful. And just so you can picture this, the stone, the mother of pearl, does not act like a flashlight or something like that. It's not like I'm reflecting it off of the light and it's just showing this big area of bright light. It's actually more like a very thin, crisp line of a laser, a vertical line. And it lights up the areas about 4 feet on either side of it, showing you what you can't see with the naked eye. We had a lot of great lighting with us, but without those stones, we never would have seen those colors. We knew that we were getting close. And sure enough, we come upon this wall of green. It's something Niles told us about and something that you can see with your naked eye. It's a wall of plants, strange plants. These plants had no place there. They should not have been there. Niles gave us the heads up that there were no obstacles hidden in that wall of green and to go on through. And that after that wall, we would find the palace. And we did. We kept our lights on, but put our stones on the front of our bodies and we kept moving forward. Through the green, we saw what Niles found before. Now, before we tried to find anything else, we wanted to familiarize ourselves with what Niles described, what he found, what he saw when he went down. So we did not use our mother of pearl at all at that time. and we saw what was left of a crumbled structure. This was so different, though, than anything else I had seen under the sea. This is not something that was abandoned. It did not fall here or sink there, and man did not bring it down anytime recently. This structure was built here, with all the lines of what would have been a foundation, but there was nothing really there. Nothing was left of it. There were no golden chariots, no piles of treasure. It was a pile of old stone rubble. What was left of some stone pillars in the front, they were broken. But it was peaceful, and it felt like just what it was, abandoned. And we could find and see what was obviously the main entrance, and we just took a look around, and we used this as a reality tour, something that we did without the Mother of Pearl. Then, using the Mother of Pearl, we looked again. As I run my laser from left to right, things are no longer old, no longer broken down into rubble. The stone is white, and the place is grand. Everything at its full height, with walls surrounding the entire thing. We take our rope of lights, and we head on in through that main entrance. And on the inside, we set our string of lights down in the front room, lighting up as much as we can, still using our Mother of Pearl, which we will have to do from now on. We're met with bright and vibrant colors. I don't think if these things were on the surface, and if you tried to shine light on them in an artful way, that even then they would show themselves in the way they're showing themselves to us at that moment. They glow from the inside out. They reflect on the water. We see the throne, something we didn't see before, and it's fitting. It's huge. From the size of Helios, now that we have seen him in person, we can tell that Poseidon's no different, maybe even bigger. This man, this guy, this being was very large. There are stone blocks to the left and right of where this throne is, and surely this would be where his most trusted confidants would sit. I mean, our imaginations are running wild, but we all know that we don't have forever to spend down there, so we need to split up and scope this place out. We planned this up on the surface. It's something that we need to do to make sure that we know where we are and what's around us. Harley goes off to the left of the throne, Jagger goes to the right, and Frankie and I dip in behind it and head straight for the back. Back to an area where, with the naked eye, looked like it had crumbled down to nothing. There's nothing there. But it was not nothing now. Without those Mother of Pearl, we would not be seeing any of this. It's pretty amazing. It actually made me kind of sad right then that Niles couldn't be with us. This was his discovery, after all, his real find. He would want to be here more than anybody. But each and every one of us have individual cameras that we have set up to record. They're on our person. Mine is feeding back to our subterranean rig. And so, really, Niles should be able to see where I am at all times if it's working. We, of course, won't know if it carries the signal all the way back until we get there, but I hope it is. There are many things that we find on the way to the back of this large structure. There are different jewels. There are some treasures. It's obvious that someone sifted through what was there, though, and that this is what was left. Kind of like how something looks when someone moves out and they leave things behind. Kind of looked like that. You got that feeling. This is how Poseidon would have left it when he took off for his next and new home. We found the broken tips of what we would assume came from a trident. Can't be sure, of course, but what else could it be? Poseidon always had his trident. He could call up the seas and spearfish. And I guess it would make sense that over years and years and years, he would move on to bigger and better and improved tridents. And all that stuff is great, but none of that is what we came for. When Frankie and I get to the area we're specifically looking for, we send a notice through the monitors for Jagger and Harley to meet us. According to Niles, there was a type of stable, if you will, in the palace. Down below is where he would keep his horses and his chariots. Might seem strange to some that don't know much about Greek mythology that the god of the sea would also be the god of horses. Some say he actually invented them. You can take that for what you want to, but either way, he had a special place for them and the chariots they would carry him in. Frankie and I each take a side and start to scan the end of the structure with our Mother of Pearl. And we see the gates to this area. There are large metal gates that open up into this space below the palace. With our Mother of Pearl still shining on the scene, Harley and Jagger get to work opening the gates. And I know we're all thinking it. We're actually going down into this thing. And this is part of what Leo was talking about. When we were up top on the ocean floor and in the main level of this palace, things at least still felt a little bit normal. It's easier for us to remember that we're just there moments ago out in the ocean when there was nothing. But now that we're getting more involved, you know, we're going inside, it changes things a bit. We have to stay focused and we cannot forget that none of this is actually really there, not in our reality. And if we were to lose our mother of pearl all of a sudden, or if somehow they vanished, for instance, what would happen then? That's why we each have one to help cover ourselves. But you can't help but think, what if? Would we be buried at sea instantly? When we looked at this place before we looked through the mother of pearl, there was nothing here. There was no opening to anything down below. It was a flat surface. We need to remember that we are in this place and that we need to get out of this place. We need to remember why we're there. One of us will be reflecting our mother of pearl at all times. We are each other's backups. Before we go in, we give each other an acknowledging nod, and then we make our way. Down inside, it's exactly as Niles would have expected, what he thought would be there and what he hoped for. Two lines of stalls on each side, one on the right, one on the left, and the stalls are very, very large. And as we walk down and make our way, we can see that they held chariots. Each one we're checking out in detail. Some are empty, but we can assume that the horses would be in these stalls with their chariots. Now, we can only imagine what went on here, but it's pretty fascinating to try to think about all the action and everything that could have taken place right here, even though it wasn't even really there. It's mind-boggling. It's not until we get to the very end that we see a stall with a broken door. Inside that is another old chariot. And even with the Mother of Pearl, it still looks broken down because they're all old, not cared for. As we pass the Mother of Pearl over it again, however, we do see a glimpse of light, something we didn't see with the other chariots. Frankie walks up to it and rubs his glove along one of the side rails, and sure enough, pure gold. This is very good timing too, because as we look down, we are limited on the time we have left. I mean, humans are not meant to be down here after all at all, so we do have our limits. So we get to work digging out this chariot, and we're cleaning it along the way. I mean, it's very obvious it was left here with no regard. Poseidon did not want this, or so it would sure seem to us. It's how it looked. According to the map that we received from Niles that's programmed into our monitors, if we continue past the stalls, we should come upon another gate. Only this gate is on the ceiling. If we were Poseidon, I'm sure that this gate would open up on command, but we're not. So Frankie and I stay with the chariot, and again, Jagger and Harley get to work on the gate. They actually need to use their propellers a bit for strength because the gates are heavy, and they start to get it, and they actually do get one of them open, and when they do, an interesting thing happens. The chariot, as if it's not already gold enough, starts to glow beyond what it was, because we have it all cleaned off now. The light starts to get so bright even, it's almost hard to look at. And then we also start to hear a rumbling from above. Not soon after the rumble, it's not hard for any of us to miss the other effect that's going on. The water is starting to swirl around us. It's almost as if the water's angry or agitated. In the same instant, I know we're all thinking the exact same thing. Have we been found out? Could Poseidon be here and have we upset him? I look up to Harley and Jagger and they stop doing what they're doing. And Frankie and I leave the chariot to go back to the entrance of the underground stables to see if we can find out what's going on. And boy, do we. We don't even get our heads popped up to the next level when the largest man in the world rushes over and hovers over us. And when I say largest man, I don't even know what else to call him. But either way, Helios was big enough, but Poseidon, he was even bigger. He had a long white beard and he was dressed in blue robes. Not like a royal blue, more of like a light blue. And he had a trident, so whatever was left behind is obviously something he didn't need anymore. We just looked up at him and he let out this sound. It wasn't a growl. It wasn't a yell. It wasn't a happy, mad, or sad anything. It actually had no emotion at all. It was just a very loud sound. And when he did that, you could just feel the vibrations moving through the water. This was one of those moments when we really just didn't know what was going to happen, not to mention the fact that we weren't even there in the first place, right? See, this gets a little hard mentally. We had to keep our grip. And all I'm thinking is, I really don't want to end up part of the seabed anytime soon. Without us doing a single thing, he backs away, and we are pulled up and out of the opening. So I kind of got my wish from earlier. We're on the surface now, surface of the ocean floor, if that makes sense. But Harley and Jagger are still down in the stables. I don't look their direction, and it's not like I can really say anything anyway, so we're just there, just standing there. And he's floating back and forth in front of us, and you can just feel the ripples of water hitting us as he does that. And I can't stress enough that this is one big guy. And then he starts making these facial expressions, and I realize he's sniffing. He's sniffing under the water. He sticks his head back down into the entrance to the stables, and then he backs away, and sure enough, up come Jagger and Harley. He pulled them up, and they're stunned. But then what happens next is even more crazy. Poseidon holds up his trident with his left hand and holds up his right arm. They're directly in front of him. And then he slowly starts to separate them so his arms are moving out to his sides. And as he does that, the water separates with him. As his hands go, so does the water. It's not like the separating of the seas or anything. It's forming more of a dome above us and around us. I mean, there's still water where we are. We just end up standing in about waist-deep water instead of being fully underwater. And he is in and out of the water below and in the water dome, you know, always having his bottom half submerged, I guess, so he can keep moving. And then suddenly, without us doing anything, the seals to our viewports unlatch and our small bubble windows open up like doors extending out. We take in breaths. We can breathe. At this point, I don't think any of us know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, because it's all very overwhelming and we are in a most vulnerable state at this point. We were so close to getting the chariot, and that's all we came for. And honestly, I did not really expect Poseidon to show up like this at all, but he did. And this is one of those situations that sometimes you guys ask about, you know, weren't we terrified? Weren't we scared? Well, sure. But at the same time, we have to always be accepting. It's part of our work, part of our job. Every single job we do is unbelievable and outrageous. I always tell you guys that. There's a different mindset for work like that. And so in your initial shock, you have that, but then you need to immediately move over to this place of acceptance. And that's where we're at in that moment. Our lives are in his hands, basically. There's nothing we can do about that. Since we're not really in a place that exists for us, we can't even really be sure about anything at that point. It's sort of a long, drawn-out process. He actually tries to converse with us in this larger-than-life, low-echoing voice. His English is not very clear. His voice is a bit rattled, but he's forceful nonetheless. He belts out that he knows we came with the sun, meaning, of course, we came with Helios, and he asks if we expect to ride out of there and into the skies. And we can only answer the truth, and we tell him no. He explains to us while he continues his water pacing that the sun has crossed the skies too many times between the last time he's even seen the surface and now. And then with a tone that it was hard to tell if he was feeling regretful or a bit somber or even annoyed, he tells us he doesn't need to go to the surface because the people keep coming down, says we're only the second to make it to the palace. And then he takes his trident and he points it down towards me. I mean, my arms are out to my sides, and he actually taps the front of my mother of pearl that's on my chest. And then he says, "Ah, you have brought the eye." And then he pulls his trident back and he leans down in closer to all of us. I mean, the guy's so large, it's not like he can just look at one of us. And in a lower, almost whisper of a water voice, he tells us that we are not meant to be there. And I have to say, that sent a chill down my spine. We were in his territory. We knew we were going into his territory the whole time. I'm both fascinated and a little bit freaked out. This guy is in control of the room right now, of the whole place. It's really up to him what happens next. We don't have a defense against something that isn't really even there for us to see, anywhere for us to be. It's there, but it isn't. We go around about why we're there and what we're doing. There's no way to hide it. He knows why we're in the stables. There's only one thing that might have ever been worth anything or of value again down there, and it was the golden chariot. We went around and around through a series of questions and answers and a lot of confusion. We do start to make sense of some of it. Poseidon is brother to Zeus. Zeus is the one, if you remember, that took down and killed Helios' son, Phaethon. It would seem there was more to Poseidon leaving that particular chariot than just him up and leaving and not wanting to take everything. Poseidon and Zeus were known for their sibling rivalry, although they were brothers in the end. The gods were an odd bunch, though. They each had their thing, right, but they were also very unreliable. Emotions all over the place, people cheating with other people, constant fights and wars going on, one wanting this over the other. And with this, from what we figured out, Poseidon left that chariot as a just-in-case. He was leaving it to fate. Said it was their feud between Helios and Zeus, and he didn't want to be in the middle. He didn't want to be a pawn in their game. The chariot would not be hidden with him any longer. It was not his job, and in the end, he didn't want it. Poseidon never liked the fact that Zeus actually killed Phaethon. He said so much as that to us. I mean, Zeus was careful to save the chariot over the boy, in fact. Zeus was a perfect shot, and he knew what he was doing. Poseidon left the chariot behind because he simply didn't want it. He didn't want to be the one left with it. No one should have that chariot except for Helios, he said, so he would leave it there in the stables. And if it was meant to be, Helios would find it. If not, then at least Poseidon knew he was not the one who had it. I mean, did this guy actually have feelings? After what sort of felt like we were having a small moment there, in an instant, everything started changing again. The water started to fill up again, and our viewports slammed shut, and they latched all by themselves. So we're now taking breaths from our masks to regain our footing, and this water is filling up the dome that was our space. Poseidon, back to his low and loud voice, calls to us to send a message to Helios that this is the end of it. The chariot is his, and any further quarrel on this is to be between Zeus and himself. He wants nothing to do with it and considers the matter closed. Now, not only is our dome filled with water, water starts to swirl once again, and I'm talking big swirls. And in a bunch of bubbles and everything else, all we could see was Poseidon go towards the front of the palace. Almost like he was sucked up by it, but more like he was in complete control of it. And then there we were once again. We were all looking at our gauges now because we had only had a certain amount of time left to get back. With all that happened, I was worried that we might only have minutes left. But to our surprise, like I said, this job was full of surprises. Our gauges hadn't moved. They were just as they were when we were down in the stables. I mean, could it be possible that Poseidon stopped time? Well, no. What happened is that we're not in our time anyway. We're in their time. He took his moment, and it means nothing to our time. Either way, we'll take it, though, because we need that time, and we need to start to move. More than ever, we just want to get what we came for and get out. And we're moving about this place as if we know it now. Like Leo said, it's a trick of the mind. This all seems real to us at this point. And technically it is, for that time we're there. And we need to work with it as such, but we need to remember where we're at. We do a small touch base, the best that we can, and then we go back down to the stables to finish what we started, which is to get that chariot out of there. We get back into position, and Jagger and Harley get to work again on trying to get that second gate open. Then we started to notice these small bubbles. They're coming up from the ground and they're rising up all around us. We're all looking at them as they rise up. And then Jagger and Harley start to back away from the gate that they're working on. Not knowing why at first, Frankie and I soon figure it out. The gate starts to open all by itself. And beyond it is this whitish, bluish glow in the water. And then the chariot starts to move, and it's brighter than it even was before. We see Poseidon's trident come through the now open gates, and it's pointed at the chariot, which, as if on command, starts to rise up. Frankie and I follow it as it passes through the metal gates, and then Jaeger and Harley follow us. The trident is then pulled back, and it seems like it goes a long ways, but sure enough, as the bubbles clear, we see him one last time. It's Poseidon. He says nothing. The bubbles grow in size and surround him, and then once again, he's off. We watch as the blue glow of his presence gets smaller in the distance until eventually it disappears altogether. We're left with this floating chariot in the water. We can see it now more in its entirety, and it's like everything else we've seen. It's beyond what we could ever find here on Earth in our reality. And what we find out next is even when we take our Mother of Pearl away and don't use it, we can still see the golden chariot. It is really here with us, and we're just in awe of all that's going on. Again, without the Mother of Pearl, we turn around and look back on what was the palace. The palace we see is now how it is to us here in our world, our reality. It's back to rubble. We've moved beyond it now, and we just need to make our way back. We're not going to go back and look around. Our home target is easy to find because our rope of lights is still laying in the front of the room where we left it, which we can now see from the outside. It's just there, mixed in with the ocean floor. The chariot, if it could be, seems to almost be willing to go with us. It's very easy to move. We can push it through the water, no problem. We make it back to the lights, and we take a moment to just look around. We see the base, we see the broken pillars, and what is left of something left many years ago. A place that at one time was part of our reality in a way, but now is something we can barely find or see. We can only see the broken pieces of what would have been part of our world all those years ago, when everyone believed. We take in the moment, but then we need to get back to the rig. And when we do, we find that Niles is actually in a suit, an atmospheric suit, and he's waiting outside for us, something that he should not be doing. But I can understand why he's doing it. This is something that he will never see again, most likely. And in the end, he was the one that went looking for it in the first place. After he studies the chariot for a few minutes, we take our last few, and then we get it wrapped in a cover that they had set up for it. We get the lights spooled back up, and then we get the chariot all attached to the rig, and we finally get inside. We're all a bit, well, emotional, to tell you the truth. The experience was something that pushed what we knew we could see or do. It makes the saying, "That was unreal," take on a whole new meaning for the four of us and Niles. Our job now is to get this chariot to the predetermined, out-of-the-way rendezvous spot, which is the island of Gabdos. It's actually the southernmost tip of Europe, if you didn't know. And there's not much there. It will take us another day, day and a half to get there. During that part of the journey, we have some more good time with Leo. He is very interested in what the trip into the mythological felt like and what it did to us. And we really were a collective on this. It did a number on us. It was like trying to understand the world of the paranormal for the first time. This reality or world, well, I don't really want to call it a world because it was all here with us. It was something we experienced. It was very real. Coming out of it, none of us could help having these heavy emotional feelings, and none of us could pinpoint what they even were exactly. It was just a feeling of being emotionally overwhelmed. Out on the sea and taking in the salty air, we were all thinking the same thing. We didn't even need to come out and say it. We were thinking about Poseidon. And who knew we'd be thinking about him at all on this trip? We really were thinking about all of it together. I mean, we saw it. We've had more than one interaction at this point, and we know that, even though it can't be, right? But it was. Are you getting the emotional confusion here? We were overcome by it. We as a people back then gave them their arguments, their feelings. They've had their wins and their losses. And it was almost as if Poseidon knew. It was like he knew their time was almost up. And before it all went down, he wanted to be cleared of at least this one thing. And we were witness to it. So how do you sit with all of that and go about life the same way? It was actually good we had that sailing time to get our heads back into the game of our lives, our real world. But that said, that clarity and calm would be interrupted just one more time on the island of Gabdos. We got there just ahead of full dawn. The water and skies were calm and clear. The island was quiet. And we stayed a bit out, by the way. We didn't just pull up to the island and sit there. We needed to keep the chariot out of view, and we needed to stay on the boat. You could see that the sun was almost ready to show itself, but not quite yet. We uncovered the chariot, and you could just sense the power and energy coming from it. This thing was very hard to control, as the stories go, and that's what got Helios' son in trouble in the first place, that and the horses. And this thing's been held back for a long time, deep in the sea. And this feeling came over us that it actually had its own feelings coming from it, like it had waited all of this time and was just waiting to be let loose, like a racehorse waiting for that mechanical gate to open and set them free. It was just like that. And sure enough, as the chariot brought out its bright light once again, we saw another light coming from the sky. From up and over the island, we see this bright yellow light. It was Helios. Bigger than life, he flies over into us as if dropping out of the sky. And you'd think we would all be besides ourselves during all of this, but really, after what we'd been through, we really were just there to watch it all go down. As soon as he got a hold of that chariot, that would mean our job was done. To our surprise, though, yep, again, he dove into the water. That was not something we expected, but he did it. So we wait for a few seconds, and then he comes back up, and he just shoots out of the water. He comes up, and we're all looking at that, but then four fiery horses come flying down out of the sky after him. And in this giant swirl of light and wind, Helios and the horses and the chariot, they were all reunited, and they take off. Helios shoots up, goes out over the ocean, and then comes back. And he hasn't even said a word to any of us or made any sound at all, though his looks have said a lot. He's a man on a mission, and he's acknowledging all of us, almost putting on a show for us or something. As he sits in his chariot above us, the light from the whole thing growing, and it's almost too much to bear, really, we see him look back out over the ocean. And so we look too, and in the very far distance, we see it. It's a bright blue light. It's far away, but it's there. We know it, and you know it. It was Poseidon. The two have acknowledged each other. We can only assume that's why Helios dove into the water, to let Poseidon know he was there. And we were there for all of it. Wow. The ball of light and fire and all that was Helios took off after a nod to us all. But before he actually did take off, he did leave one thing. From the chariot, he throws this ball of light, and it moves in slow motion. It slowly makes its way down to Leo. As it made its way, Helios shot out across the sky. This ball of light ends up with Leo, and he's holding it in his hands. And you're going to have to stick with me here, because this is pretty hard to explain. What lands in Leo's hands was something that no one will ever see anywhere else. It was like this ball of golden crystals, and they were shaped in a sphere. But as he moved it through his hands, they'd separate and move while still being one thing, glowing and making this high-pitched chime sound, sort of how fairy dust sounds in animated films. It was just like that. Magical. Leo had this in his hands, and he really didn't know what to do with it. So he motions over to this chest that he had on deck, and inside of it, he had a glass bottle with a wooden cork in it. And the guy always had all kinds of things, so this was no surprise. Well, we remove the cork, and Leo holds his hands above the bottle and lets the small but not so small specks of glowing gold fall into it. I mean, afraid it would just up and disappear or something, he quickly puts that cork back on the bottle. And right at that moment, we saw the sun peek out from the horizon. There it was, the sun. Helios? Who could even say at this point? It was a long trip back, and there were a lot of heavy and deep conversations that happened along the way. We were relaxed, but exhausted by the time we got back. And back at Leo's place, where we finally end up, we're all just staring up at that painting of Helios. Leo sets his glowing bottle of gold next to the one with the gold and water that he had from before. That one was not glowing like it was before, but Leo addresses it, reflecting on the fact that this bottle, like I said in part one, was supposedly gold passed down over time from Helios's chariot. Just a story? Not sure, was it? We know what we have now, although no one would believe it. And you can now know this bottle, too, would be passed down. Again, a wow. Leo put the recordings of the dive into a safe, and then we all turned to the Book of Truths, which was still there as we left it. No one touched it since that first day we were there, but Leo picks it up and is just amazed at how much of what was inside of it came true. And he's flipping through the pages, and then he calls us over urgently. And when we get there, he sits down, and so we all gather around, and he's holding this book out in front of him so that we can all see. The book is changing. It's literally rewriting itself. Instead of how Helios would ride again, those words are changing to, since he took to his chariot once again, and then it just keeps going. The pages of Poseidon also. This book of truths is something of magic. It is in alignment with the myths, in a sense, blending it more and more with the reality of today. It was amazing to see. The truths will change with how history is being made. Things change and the future becomes the past. Isn't that how it is with all things, though? If this is really a book of truths, this would have to be so. It just would. We were in no rush to leave Leo and Niles. We stayed a bit longer, closing out our visit with a dinner at the very restaurant where it all began for us. None of us would be the same after this job. It puts you in a place that almost makes it hard to get out in words. This job was a lot, hence the two parts to this story. There was just too much to it. And if you ever got a hold of any one of us that was there, we could talk about this job for hours. Guaranteed, now that I shared this with you guys, it will be on all of our minds, and we will end up reflecting on this one as we do many jobs on New Year's Eve. It will happen. The job became a part of us. Believe in Greek gods or don't, there are still points that we took, and maybe you can. The quarrels, the guilt, the things we don't want to take with us, the things that make us great, and the things that we may not be able to hold on to forever. It's all a part of it. And we have the ability to rewrite our stories, just as the Book of Truth so blatantly showed us it was doing. That's what it is. That's what it all is. Our lives are made of truths that we rewrite and can rewrite every single day. And there we are. That's the end of part two and the final part to this one job, a job full of many things. It pushed us physically and mentally and bonded all of us. It was more than a job. It was an eye-opening, self-realizing experience. Setting any of your beliefs or non-beliefs about Greek gods aside, I hope you can appreciate that. I appreciate that you could be here with me today, to come on this journey with me. I've got more stories to share, and we're close to a new year ahead of us. Okay, until next time, guys, and I will talk to you all soon.